Thank you. The recordings have been started. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's HSTLD Advisor Group Conference call, where we had planned today to have a follow-up discussion to last week's call with folks that had submitted questions on the RFI. Before we start the call, let me at least acknowledge those that are on the phone. We have Mikey O'Connor, Michael Pelage, Lynn Goodendorf, and John McElwain. Is there anybody else who is joining us who I have not called out by name? Hearing none. And I thought that Paul Smosher might join us today, but I don't see that he's dialed into the call yet. So, Michael, if you want to take the floor, we can go ahead and
get started. All right, yeah, thanks, Craig. I think this will be hopefully a short call. I just wanted to follow up on last week's call, which I personally found very informative and I think provided us with a lot of facts to sort of, if you will, go back and, if you will, make some recommendations. So once we get their full responses. So I thought last week's call was pretty constructive. And will provide sort of, a springboard for us to complete our final report and recommendations. So that was my take. I guess what I'd like to do is see if everyone else was on that same page or perhaps had a different take or a viewpoint. Mikey, what was your take of last week's call as far as, you know, positives or negative takeaways?
I thought it was good, too. I think it highlights the sort of forest and trees problem that we've got. I mean, you know, the call was very much about the mechanics of auditing and who can do what and this and that. And I think just like in the working group, you know, we seem to have a pretty good grasp of the details, but I'm still not sure that we know whether this is going to work. And so I thought it was a great call and enjoyed being on it, but I do think we've still got some really fundamental things that we need to puzzle out.
Well, I mean, so let me ask you this question, Mikey. I definitely saw some potential problems there with that certification. And, you know, it was interesting how they were talking about how people would attest and then they kind of will verify or will audit and do a sampling based upon representations made by the registry, which it was funny because I was like, wow, that sounds a lot like the original report card that I had put forward for consideration by the group. I did hear, I thought, as well, concern regarding, if you will, some type of certification or seal. And John, maybe you could perhaps just, I'll interject here just for a second. Did you hear that same concern from their standpoint as far as like a seal, that being potentially more complex from, if you will, an ownership enforcement type standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. What struck me is that at least the folks that were getting interested in this program are interested not in administering it and policing it, which is what like an underwriter laboratories does. You know, they actually take in the products, they test them under, you know, conditions and certify them to meet a certain level of safety. That's the type of certification that is classic and in which the certifier is going to have liability. what everybody on the call wants to do is make money off of auditing folks to prepare data or, shall we even say, opinions concerning their level of compliance with a set of criteria that is to be developed. And that is striking me more like an ISO standard. And my biggest takeaway from the conference call was that we are not gaining traction really within the group so much, but particularly within the community in a certification program, and certainly not with ICANN, and that we ought to learn a little bit more. I just haven't been – I'm a lawyer. I haven't been involved in ISO certifications and really understand how those benefit the companies meeting such certifications and the public that is benefiting by such certifications. I do know that from my research, ISO doesn't have any certification marks anywhere. So there is a different framework surrounding an ISO certification, and we need to, if we don't have anybody on this call, or as we've been saying, our sort of core group of people that understand that, we need to bring in some expertise to help us understand how our criteria can fit into an ISO-like standard, which I think is arguing, you know, you were very wise, Michael, going to be more like a report card than a certification.
Yeah, this is Lynn, and John, I've had experience working with ISO on the security standards in the ISO 27000 series, and you're absolutely right that ISO's approach is that they don't actually do any certifying themselves. They're a standards body, and so they focus on providing various kinds of standards and keeping those standards up to date. And they're also consensus-driven. They work very hard to engage a wide and diverse community so that their standards will be, you know, well accepted. I had a similar takeaway to you that I thought it was significant on the last call that the interested parties were interested in being evaluators but not administering the program. And then Craig Schwartz was kind enough to follow up with Trustee for us because I had expected Trustee to be interested in the RFI. And their feedback, was that when they read the RFI, they interpreted it as a security audit kind of function. And they said that was a different kind of strategic direction for them and that as a result they had chosen not to respond. And so that was very revealing to me because Trustee runs the very kind of SEAL programs that I thought we were, conceptualizing. And I'm familiar with their other programs, which they do administer. And so, I wondered if we as a group on this point about us being kind of in the details and not seeing the forest for the trees, maybe we all unconsciously have approached this with a mindset of like how how it would be implemented and who would evaluate it rather than thinking about what would be involved in administering the program. So I wonder if this feedback isn't from Trustee is actually confirming what we heard from the interested parties. Trustee has also offered to help us any way they can, and I'm wondering if it would be useful to invite them to just give us some kind of informative presentation about their SEAL programs. And, they've got several different ones, and they're respected and they're well-known. So maybe that would be useful to us as a group.
Okay, Lynn. So what happens is I think everyone knows my style, which is sure.
Yeah.
Now, I guess from a timing standpoint here, next week many people or many of us will be in Cartagena, And so we may want to sit there and schedule something for the following week. Craig, when did the submission deadline close, or did it close?
It will close the 17th of December.
17th of December, okay. All right, 17th of December. So what happens, Lynn, is perhaps we may be able to have a call with a trustee to listen to them and sort of get their perspective, because I think, and this goes to what I think Mikey has tried to raise, is there are some different sort of conflicting viewpoints of the certification versus report card versus what the auditors want to do. You know, my takeaway from last week, again, this is my personal opinion, was that I see this as far as what is achievable in the short term is a program not unlike sort of what we have with the UDRP, where ICANN says, here's the policy, you know, and, you know, they would be the keeper of the control elements. You know, so the HSTLD would somehow continue to exist or would take in some type of new embodiment where people would be the caretaker of those control elements. And then ICANN, just like they select UDRP providers, WIPO, NAF, they would accredit the KPMGs, the Arthur, you know, the Accentures, those people of the world, to come in and then do their auditing functions. And you then get a sort of a, I don't use the word report, but you get a report that says you met these control elements, or, you know, you haven't. You know, you get evaluated on where you stand against those control elements. And that to me was something that was scalable in size, because if we were able to show that that was working, that process was working, and it was in fact bringing there was a value add to that component, then what you do is you get to what Mikey talks about of how do you take that value and begin to propagate it down the trust chain, right? And then at that point in time, that's maybe where you come in and begin to use a seal that is more visible on consumer or registrar websites. I mean, again, I was just trying to look at this from a scaling standpoint. And again, this is just my own personal opinion.
Right.
And that's where I was coming from. So, you know, I guess, Mikey, you're always sort of the devil's advocate of issues. Is that something that you think is a workable solution, or in your view is just inherently flawed like many of the other things we've discussed?
You know, my view is puzzled, I think, is the best. You know, like Columbo on the TV show. I'm
Definitely
puzzled about this.
Man. Anyway, go ahead. You're puzzled. What?
I'm puzzled. Well, you know, I think that the point I've been trying to make ineffectively is to kind of come at the problem from the other end and say, look, what does a high-security TLD need to be in order to be highly secure? And how can we make sure that those things are actually delivered? And I'm not sure that the very detailed list of auditable things that we've got actually delivers a secure TLD. It delivers something that can be audited, for sure. But I'm quite willing to continue to explore all kinds of options, and I certainly don't want to be on record as saying that I'm opposed to doing a high-security TLD. I think that they can be very valuable. I'm just not sure that we've figured out how to ensure that the TLD will actually be secure, and for whom.
Well, and I think, Mikey, this points out, too, again, that I'm starting to think that as a group we have had some kind of unconscious bias or mindset where we've looked at this through the lens of auditing. You know, we've had an auditing perspective on it. And that certainly is an important aspect of it. But again, it's not only puzzling but troubling to me that trustees' feedback is that they don't think that what we're asking for is what they do. And if you look at their SEAL programs, that's exactly the kind of thing we want to do. So there's a disconnect somewhere. And, you know, Michael, even though I didn't agree with publishing a report card or having a published report card, I think we all did come to an agreement that we have to have some way of measuring whether or not somebody meets a standard. You know, it's just a question of whether or not that is those details of specifically how somebody did on their measurements is what, from a security perspective, I didn't feel comfortable with. But again, I just have this uncomfortable feeling that that we've somehow I don't think it's like it would take a lot more time, but I think we've somehow focused too much on the auditing view of this.
Okay. Lynn, let me ask this, John. Let me ask a question real quick to help me understand it. If somebody claims to be ISO, I know like ISO 9000, but one of those ISO certifications that you've worked with, if they claim to be certified and they're not, what kind of trouble do they get in, and who gets in trouble?
You know, I'm an old manufacturing guy. Let me try at that. Basically, these days, vendors will insist, or customers will insist in their agreements that the ISO certification be maintained. And if it turns out that it's not, then that it's a breach. It's basically often handled through contract law. And, you know, so if you're supplying Sony with a whole bunch of really nifty parts and suddenly you're not certified, boom, there's your deal gone.
Okay. Lynn, do you know how it works in a security setting?
Yeah, for ISO themselves, they have a process for certifying bodies, but they themselves don't certify. And so different companies who want to be a ISO certifier or certifying body have a process that they go through with ISO, and then their individual organizations is what you know, a company would retain to obtain the certification.
And then you're allowed to mention that in any way you want, then, as a company that has been I guess audited and deemed compliant with a standard, then you're allowed to put on your website, you know, ISO whatever you said 2600 compliant or something to that effect.
Right, right. And so, I mean, it does minimize the effort and resources by ISO, but I mean it still has the ISO name attached to it, and you know, they still have to be cognizant of whether or not a certifying body has been approved by them or not.
And Michael, that sounds a lot like your idea concerning an authorized sort of UDRP type situation, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, because doesn't ICANN in some way acknowledge the WIPO UDRP process? I mean, I don't know what the terminology is that they use. I don't know if they call it endorsed or
accredited.
Or accredited?
Yeah.
Well, WIPO is an accredited UDRP provider.
Okay.
So there's a UDRP process that was developed, Michael, you know, how many years ago, and then there are 1999, and then there are a number of UDRP accredited providers like WIPO and the Czech arbitration
Court, NAS,
Yeah. I think they're like four or five.
Oh, okay. WIPO's the only one I'm familiar with.
So, you know, my personal opinion is that in light of what the ICANN board has said, in light of what all of the people have been interested so far in the RFP process have said, we probably need to go down that path. That doesn't foreclose, Lynn, a certification program later on down the road, because what trustee could come in and say, we're going to layer a few other requirements on top of this, plus you need to be, you know, ICANN, whatever, HSTLD compliant as well. So, I mean, I see as the next sort of step would be this Michael's idea of there being accredited auditors to a set of standards that ICANN maintains that would be considered a high security top level domain.
All right, and put it this way, then, John, would this sort of go, the idea of what I was trying to get across, and again, this is my own personal opinion here, is the idea of doing something that has scalability, right? You know, and this is kind of one of my criticism slash concern regarding the entire new GTLD process as a whole, is there's not a lot of scalability, you know, designed in. You know, if I can take 500 TLTs, that kind of scares the shit out of me. But, you know, what we've done here is we've provided a platform where we could, you know, again, I don't think it's going to be that hard for ICANN to accredit KPMG to administer, a set of control criteria that, you know, have been developed. You know, it is not that much of an extensive due diligence process.
Well, and to Mikey's point, we ought to have at least some initial likely candidate accredited auditors provide us input as to whether these controls we've come up with are sufficient, need to be tweaked, or, you know, would end up costing $1.8 million to go through all those steps, and nobody would want to get, you know.
Exactly, and that's exactly my point there, John, is what we do is we take baby steps.
Yeah.
Right? We sit there, we say, this is a framework. And then what happens is we go, we accredit it, you know, at first there may be two or three accountancy firms that come forward. And it wouldn't surprise me if the two or three that come forward are the two or three that are probably providing services to the existing GTLD registries right now, right? Thinking
their
client may want to do that. The question then becomes is, does someone do this? And we don't know. And this is kind of where I think we want to let the marketplace provide somewhat of a market-driven solution, because let's just suppose a vendor, hypothetically, the World Bank applies for a dot bank. You know, under the criteria, you know, I don't think BITS or the Financial Services Roundtable would be, I think, objecting to the World Bank applying for a dot bank. So if they did that and then they decided, hey, we're going to be choosing a back-end provider, I could see a VeriSign or affiliate saying, hey, let me spend the extra money to tick these boxes to show them what a great guy I am to solicit that business, right? We don't know,
right?
What we do is we see if it happens. And this goes to Mikey's point. If we take these small incremental steps to, if you will, plant a garden, and nothing but weeds pop up or it's totally a barren wasteland, then what we do is we said we tried. There was no market demand. It was non-viable. We tried it. It didn't work, and we walk away. But let's just suppose it does work, right? And if it does, if the garden begins to flourish, we then have the ability, I think, to come in and say, hey, what can we do to perhaps provide some level of certification, a seal, a mark, or something like that, or someone else to come in and provide that, and do something that begins to, if you will, trickle down in the trust value chain, the chain of trust to sort of registrars or end users. You know, I think that's what we do from an incremental standpoint. You know, and put it this way, Dave, Craig said you had just joined. You know, wearing your engineering hat, when I served on the board with Vint and Crocker, the two things they always drilled down into my head was scalability. Is what I've sort of discussed here something that you see as scalable, or am I just, off base? You know, I would appreciate your view as sort of more of an engineer of is this something, as I've described it, provides scalability?
Well, actually, the two things David Clark used to say to Steve and to Vint was, can I scale it and can I make it secure? I think it's possible. I think scaling that a program of this nature is probably going to be very difficult if it's monolithic. We've heard a lot of people, who were responded to the RFI indicate that trying to do a certification. The size and scale of what we embraced in the initial version of the HSTLD program might be a little bit daunting. But I think that it can be made modular, and I think that it could be implemented in a manner that would allow people to report very very crisply what criteria they satisfy and what criteria they don't. So in that sense, if you can make it modular and you can make the reporting granular, then I think it will scale. And since the basis of the program is to try to improve the security baseline for the registry, then I think it is, Mike.
Okay. And again, that's just for the hardcore people on the phone. This is just something literally that my own personal opinion, and again, as chair, I will always, the final report will reflect all the diversities and viewpoints. I just want to make that clear. Well, listen, it's at the top of the hour here. I think what I'd like to do is just go through each of the individual callers here. Give them sort of, if you will, a couple of minutes to identify what they see as sort of action items that we need to take regarding deliverable dates to get our work done. But before we start that, Craig, you and I have, I think, talked informally about some benchmarks. We started that last week on the call before I got disconnected. So perhaps as our staff liaison here, who is definitely steering the ship, and we'll have sort of the pen, you and I will have the pen on the final document here. Could you perhaps share with the group what you think the remaining timeline of our deliverables are? And then I will solicit feedback from the members as to whether that's reasonable or not from their perspective.
Sure, Mike. Well, I'm just trying to dig up that email right now. So the timeline that I sketched out, and this was sent around to the advisory group on the 15th of November, following the 17 December RFI response due date, I'm reconvening our weekly call starting on the 5th of January. So we would have a call on the 5th, the 12th, the 19th, the 24th, the 26th, continuing on to 2 February, 9 February, getting to near consensus by the 9th, tweaking and dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's by the 16th of February, so we could actually post the HSTLD's final report by the 21st of February, which kind of meets the timeline for something that would be discussed at the next ICANN meeting, which is in San Francisco in March. So that's the general timeline. Before I lose my train of thought on this, I did want to kind of interject with one potential other item that Lynn brought up, and that is whether the folks on the call, feel like there's value in inviting representatives from trustee perhaps to join a call on what would be the 15th of December, which is after the ICANN meeting's concluded and everybody's had a chance to make their way back to, you know, wherever they're traveling to, perhaps have them participate in a call on the 15th just to get a sense of how they administer their program and perhaps to hear some of the concerns that they had about what they read in RFI. Not that I think this takes us in the direction of either of modifying the RFI or pushing out the due date, but I think that that information, particularly from an organization like that, might be really helpful to us in preparing what becomes our final report. So I kind of wanted to toss that out there to see if having a call with trustee on the 15th, if they're available, is something folks here are interested in doing.
I'll weigh in there and say yes. As you know, Craig is a big believer in the affirmation of commitments. We need to make a fact-based determination, and I think based upon what Lynn has said, there are some data points that we need to get, particularly in how they interpreted the original RFI. So I would be in favor of that. As far as getting the report out on the 21st, I think you said, generally we've used, say, 2 to 3 weeks to finalize something. So I assume we would be looking to have out to the group by sort of February 1, a draft, that first week of February, sort of a draft document based upon our discussions, or...
Yeah, the date that I have in the timeline for circulating the first draft final report is the 24th of January. So it's maybe a week sooner than you had just mentioned, but it's kind of what I originally intended.
Let's put it this way. I have no problem leaving it for the 24th. If it slips, we have I think a built-in safety net. So
right.
I have no problem with anything you've said there as far as trustee, the timelines, or your proposed path. So, again, that's only my 2 cents. Perhaps I'll just go down the list. Lynn has already dropped off, so I will not be excluding her because she's no longer on the call. Mikey, you're up.
Thanks, Mike. I think the only thing that I worry about is that I want you all to know that at some point I am going to stick my hand up and say, look, we do not have agreement on a lot of this stuff. And so at some point we have to step back from this and get away from the how are we going to do this and back to the what. And so as long as you all are okay with that, it may be perceived as trying to throw a spanner in the works. I'm not really trying to do that. I'm really just trying to get us to focus on the what for a while. So with that caveat, I'm fine with that schedule.
Put it this way, Mikey, I would expect you to not change and be consistent with your actions over the last year, and I would expect nothing more, and I appreciate you know, what you bring to the process. So you know, not a problem, and I appreciate it. John, you're up.
I'm fine with that time frame.
All right, and I think that is it, because Lynn had unfortunately dropped off. Again, Dave and Craig, thank you for the continued support, and I look forward to seeing a number of you in a couple of days in Columbia. Okay? So until the 15th call, take care and safe travels.
Thanks, Michael, and to everyone
else. Thanks, all.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.